When you step into the bustling streets of a city in India for the first time, the sensory overload can be overwhelming until you make a few friends. Hi, I'm Rick Steves. Coming up shortly on today's Travel with Rick Steves, Madhur Jaffrey gives us a delightfully personal look at the India she grew up in during the days before and after its independence from Britain. And friends from Italy explain how the apparent chaos of their country actually has a pattern to it. Once you understand how everyday life operates there, it gets a little easier to turn your frustration into a game of go with the flow and see how things work themselves out. The same philosophy comes in handy when you travel in India, where our first guest, Nick Bryant, spent years as a foreign correspondent based in New Delhi. He wrote about his adventures there in his book, Confessions from Correspondent Land, The Dangers and Delights of Life as a Foreign Correspondent. Nick, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Rick.
In your book, you have a very vivid image of how you can tilt the camera and go from desperation to affluence, illustrating the gap between rich and poor people in India. Take us there visually, if you could.
Well, I'll take you to Hyderabad, or Cyberabad, as it's sometimes called, because of its cyber technology hub that's grown up there. You can see these extraordinary mirror glass buildings with their satellites on the top of the roof, satellites which are picking up all the phone calls from America with people asking about their credit card details and things like that. And then you can tilt the camera down from those mirror glass buildings, those 21st century office buildings, to the slums down below, and they're cheek and jowl. They're right next to each other. You can tilt the camera or pan the camera from the luxury cars that you'll find usually in traffic jams in India. Most major cities in India have terrible traffic congestion because the roads simply cannot accommodate the number of cars that the middle class can now afford. You can pan the camera from those luxury cars to the children begging at the side of them, pleading with people to try and put down their windows so they can get money from them. That was always a shot I tended to resist, Rick, to be honest, because I knew that at times I was the person in that car and the camera would have been very damning of my reaction. I mean, there's so many beggars on the streets of India that you don't pull down the window to every single one.
Oh, it's a powerful experience to be in a car with your control and your wealth, and to roll down the window, you've got the real world physically coming in through the window at you.
Yeah, and India now is really this tale of two nations, super rich and a middle class who are prosperous and very ambitious.
Basically, it's...
And real poverty.
You got a billion people, you got a huge and powerful middle class, you got an elite, and then you got, what, 800 million people in poverty.
Something like that. I mean, I think the middle class is probably about 250 million now, so sort of akin to the size of the United States or approaching it, and you've got an awful lot of poverty. And I was there at a time when India was shining. That was a great slogan of the then government. They really thought that the economy was humming and India was getting a kind of level of international recognition that it hadn't got before. It was sort of seen as a bit of a basket case for so many decades.
Nick, you talk in your book about India almost waging a war against its poor. How are the poor being accommodated in India, and what are they doing with this intense situation?
Well, this is the problem. The government that came up with the India Shining slogan ended up being thrown out. Most people thought it wouldn't win re-election easily because the country seemed, on the face of it, in the urban centres, to be so prosperous. But if you went out into the countryside, you met the farmers who were committing suicide because drought had left them with no crops and no money and no hope and no future. And this was the story in large swathes of the country. I mean, you were talking to an educated middle class in the cities, but in the countryside, you were talking to an illiterate poor. And really, there's a big chasm opening up in Indian society. There's a Congress-led government now. Traditionally, they've always been more mindful of the needs of the poor, but it's an extraordinarily difficult task in raising all the boats. I mean, poverty is getting better in India. There are more people who are enjoying a more abundant life, but I mean, the problems there are just immense.
Well, in your book, Confessions from Correspondent Land, you talk about Demolition Day, when people who live in a slum are given 10 minutes to grab their belongings and clear out.
Yeah, and India would really present that as progress, that they were destroying these slums and in their place building modern office blocks and modern flats and apartment buildings. But of course, the problem was that the people who lived in the slums didn't have anywhere else to go. So literally, they were made homeless within minutes as the bulldozers sort of went through their communities. And it's an extraordinary sight. I always remember seeing a very proud woman dressed in her sari, beautiful, flawless saris. Some of the most poorest people in India are often some of the best dressed, and they take great pride in their appearance. And just seeing her home destroyed by the bulldozers with the police keeping her back from intervening, it was a very shocking sight. And that was right next to Mumbai Airport. And one of the reasons why is because the authorities in Mumbai didn't like people flying into the new India and seeing the old India right next to the runway.
I was just going to ask you about that because my memory is flying into Mumbai, taking a taxi down that freeway into the city to India Gate and going by just endless slums that seemed to break out like a rash. And my feeling was they would bulldoze it one day and next week it'd be back up again, tapping in illegally to the electrical system and just sprawling everywhere. And you can almost imagine the frustration of city planners when they can't keep those slums down.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the interesting things about those slums, they're not necessarily people who live in poverty anymore. They're middle class. Some of them are sort of lower middle class Indians who've got jobs and got an income, but simply cannot afford the kind of spiraling property prices that you get in Mumbai anymore. I mean, Mumbai is kind of like New York. It's just extraordinarily expensive place to live. People can't afford apartments. They can't afford homes. So they tend to live in these shanties and slums. And that's why they grow up so quickly, because it's not necessarily the really extreme poverty stricken. It's often middle-class people who know how to build things quickly.
Is that sort of a symptom of this movement of people in the countryside looking for work in the big cities also?
Yeah, that's always been one of the big problems with the big urban centres of India is they get this influx of people who find it very hard to make a living in the rural parts of India, so they go to the cities, and the cities have found it extraordinarily difficult to accommodate them. And it's created this huge infrastructure problem for India, as you know.
What a challenge. I mean, when you think that, well, they've got three times the people that we do in the United States, and a lot of them are packed into these massive urban centers. You write in your book about how India is in the throes of a revolution of rising expectations. Do you think that the Indians of tomorrow are going to be better off than today, or do they have some sort of a demographic time bomb in their midst?
I think many Indians will be better off. I mean, one of the great advantages that India has got over China, for instance, is the demography of India. It's a very young nation, so that's partly why it's so ambitious, partly why it's so restless, and partly why it's so energetic. One of the great disadvantages that India's got over China is the level of illiteracy in the countryside. China does much better on those kind of literacy indices. No, I think many people clearly in India will be enjoying a much better future. And hopefully the poverty-stricken too. I mean, as I say, the boats have been rising. I mean, a lot of the boats have been rising in terms of affluence and wealth, but they're not rising quickly enough.
Nick Bryant is a senior fellow with the University of Sydney. Nick earned his PhD in American politics from Oxford and was a foreign correspondent for the BBC for many years, based in New York, Washington, New Delhi, and Sydney. At the time of our interview, he had just written Confessions from Correspondent Land, The Dangers and Delights of Life as a Foreign Correspondent. It's a lively account of his adventures in India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Australia, and Guantanamo Bay during the George W. Bush and Bill Clinton presidencies. Nick has also authored When America Stopped Being Great and The Bystander, John F. Kennedy and the Struggle for Black Equality. Now, my feeling about massive societies with a billion people like China and India that are doing quite well as a whole economically is that their seas of untouchables and peasants, the lower caste, are kind of the infantry that provides the society the ability to march forward, but they're really going to be the losers. And then the modern-day Maharajas and the vast middle class is going to rise on their shoulders. What's the state of the untouchables and the low end of the caste system in India today, and how is that evolving with modernity, and do they get any of the fruits of this new prosperity?
Well, at the lower end of the caste system, you don't get so many of the awful crimes that you used to get in the past, the kind of persecution, the murder of untouchables. That's not quite as prevalent as it used to be. But, you know, clearly the caste system is this great invisible force in India, which as an outsider, it's kind of hard to make sense of and to fully explain. What you do get in India is many people feel just reconciled to their fate and reconciled to their caste, and that impacts social mobility. But one of the great things about the technological revolution that India has seen is many of the people who've reached the top of these high-tech companies and these high-tech outsourcing companies are actually people from the lower caste. So that is definitely positive. One of the things you see on a plane, for instance, it doesn't matter which caste you are, if you can afford the ticket for business class, then you can get in business class. So India's got a long way towards being an egalitarian society. It probably never will be. But there are some positive signs.
You talk about how the new rich really enjoy showing off their wealth, and this conspicuous wealth shows itself in fun ways. Do people still put refrigerators actually in their living rooms so they can let people know they got one?
Well, that was a great status symbol in the early days when, you know, these consumer durables were still pretty rare in Indian society, that rather than put the fridge in your kitchen, you put it in the middle of your lounge so that all visitors would get to see it and you'd be parading your new wealth. It's not quite as ostentatious as that, because refrigerators are now pretty commonplace and people are getting flat screen TVs and cars in the driveway. So it's not quite as bad as that. But yeah, there is still a lot of one-upmanship in Indian households and a lot of consumerism as well. Cars now have become the great status symbol. And there's a kind of gradation of cars as well. If you've got an Indian car, then you're probably just into the middle class. If you've got a Japanese car, then you're a bit above that. If you've got a European car like a BMW or a Mercedes, then you've really arrived.
So how are Hindi values at odds with commercialism and materialism, or is it a graceful kind of partnership as India progresses?
I don't think there's any contradiction at all. I mean, Hindu is a gospel of prosperity in many ways. The gods were rapacious, or many of them were, in their desire for earthly things. So I don't think there's any great contradiction in a lot of Hinduism and the accumulation of great wealth.
Are religious rituals incorporated into the business and retail world?
Yeah, one of the interesting things about buying a new car in India is often you get it blessed and you have a puja, a prayer service to celebrate your car, and you'll have sort of carnations on the engine and things like this. I mean, and again, in the stock markets in Mumbai, you know, a lot of the stock exchange firms will start the trading season or the trading week with a prayer, and they'll get a holy man in to do the business. So yeah, I mean, the separation of church and religion and money making in India, there isn't really a separation.
Oh, listening to you talk just reminds me what a delight it is to travel in India, and why it's really my favorite country on this planet to travel through. We've been talking with Nick Bryant, and Nick Bryant writes Confessions from Correspondent Land, The Dangers and Delights of Life as a Foreign Correspondent. Nick, thanks so much and good luck with your work.
Rick, many thanks. It's been my pleasure.
Our personal look at India continues in just a minute with actress, TV host, and food writer Madhur Jaffrey on her 90th birthday. She shares with us her memories of childhood in India during the Raj and World War II, and the comfort foods she enjoys from the traditions of home in Delhi. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves.